From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. From the pros down to the JV squad, everyone's trying to decide if it's safe to play right now. Can sports lead on COVID?
The Michigan High School Athletic Association has made the decision to go ahead so far. Now, that might be reviewed in August, which strikes me as crazy.
Also, the board chair for an embattled contemporary arts center talks about equity, parting ways with a director, and trying to move forward.
We're looking at the work environment much more carefully. And I think this moment of reckoning, again, means that everybody has to be a much better listener.
Plus, contemporary art as a lifelong journey.
I started buying art when I was 22 years old. I was at Ohio State. My tuition was $150. And I spent $125 for art.
Those stories and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. The head of the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit lost her job this week. Staff allege racism and mistreatment.
I think this is a moment of reckoning for everybody in every industry, including contemporary art.
Later in the program, we'll be talking with the MOCAD board chair about the decision. But first, the Michigan High School Athletic Association has given the green light for some fall sports to get underway. Golf, tennis, and cross country can begin competition August 19th and 21st. Now, as for sports like football, volleyball, and soccer, there's no decision yet. Administrators don't expect that they'll act until at least August 20th. If the experience of older athletes offer any guide to what high school play is going to look like, it's going to be an interesting season. With us to talk sports is writer and sometimes coach John U. Bacon. He is Michigan Radio sports commentator. John, it's good to hear your voice again.
Good to hear yours, April.
So this week, the entire Michigan State football team went into 14-day quarantine. We've got two staffers and one athlete at minimum testing positive. We're here. This is the end of July, right? The time when everybody said that college sports were going to make their big decisions, especially football, about what was supposed to happen. It's not looking good, is it?
Not for July 29th, July 30th, and so on, end of July. Rutgers University, as you also know, of course, is also quarantined. So there's two of the 14 teams in the Big Ten, and we have not even really started. So not promising.
Some football players have been making it known they think that the NCAA is not ready to pull the trigger on doing what's right. What is right at this point?
Hard to say. The problem with the whole thing, almost every aspect of American society is, you know, the schools, the businesses, of course, now college and high school athletics, is, you know, William Goldman, the old Princess Bride writer. Nobody knows anything. And that's kind of what we're dealing with here. It's all Wild West. We have insufficient data in almost all fronts. We're all essentially guessing. Even the smarter folks than I certainly are guessing as well. So it's hard to say, but I can say unequivocally that the NCAA has left a vacuum of leadership. Mark Emmert, who makes $2 million a year to run a nonprofit of unpaid athletes. So right there, as you can imagine, I have an issue. Who also has a full-time makeup and hair man, apparently, to handle his TV appearances, has gone AWOL and left, you know, the asylum to be run by the inmates, in this case, commissioners of Big Ten and Big 12 conferences and so on. And with no national policies, no national leadership whatsoever, this is a national issue and cannot be resolved, I don't think, regionally. So the players are right about that, that the NCAA has provided no guidance whatsoever.
Last time we talked, we were kicking around whether it might be easier to maintain college sports than pro. And I remember somebody saying something about how pro athletes being paid employees would have more motivation to abide by the rules. So, John, about the Marlins. Miami's baseball team had one COVID-positive player. The team played the Phillies on Sunday anyway, and now there are, I believe, we're up to 17 positive cases.
Right. Yeah, in other words, more than half your team. So basically your team. So their season has been suspended for a week, and how you make that up in a 60-game schedule, which is 100 games less than usual, fewer, that is not at all clear. To be clear, they've got incentives to play. They've got incentives not to play. What they can do is make a rational decision as adults based on money alone. A college kid can't do that because they're officially, of course, not employees, but student athletes. So you can't quarantine them necessarily against their wishes. all kinds of other stuff. So it's far more complicated in college than in the pros, and the pros are already screwing it up. So this is also not promising.
Yeah, rational decisions. CNN was reporting that the Marlins knew that their pitcher, Jose Urena, had tested positive and decided on a group chat not to do the game. I mean, is this the decision tree we should expect from multi-million dollar business franchises?
That's a great point. And yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, asking the passengers on a plane to vote to land the plane with, you know, two wheels or not. That's not usually how democracy works in this case. We have to have better leadership than that. Stronger policies. Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, has not done a great job. So again, baseball is infinitely easier to operate with COVID than football and certainly college football. And again, not promising.
Yeah. One NFL general manager told Yahoo Sports that there was no way that he would consider playing with an infection on his team. And, you know, the NFL is one of the many leagues that was kind of watching the baseball experience for maybe lessons to learn. Can we assume that everyone is now on the same page at this point about whether or not you should play if someone on your team is tested positive for COVID?
Sadly, we can never assume that. And we've proven that every time you walk into a Walmart and you see people without masks. So
yeah,
if one thing the United States is not right now, it's on the same page of anything. Now, I think some GMs get it. I'm equally certain, a la, you know, the guy playing sick with the Marlins, that some guys will see a chance, especially if you're in the running at the end of this shortened season. Your star pitcher tests positive but is asymptomatic. Do you play that guy or not? These are the same guys who took steroids. So I don't think their threshold for weighing cost-benefit analysis is to be modeled, basically. So some are going to get it. I hope most of them do, but there's no way all of them will.
How do you think Michigan's Big Four pro franchises stand in terms of their financial health to possibly weather another, I guess, at best, suspended season?
Well, I'd say good news for Michigan sports fans that they're probably four of the healthiest franchises around, despite the fact that last year they set the record, April, for the most losses of four major league teams in any year in the history of sports. So
that's
win losses, not healthy, financially very healthy, and all run by three families that are very dedicated to Detroit, who never threatened to move the team. So I would say Detroit is far more stable than most.
You know, I wonder if this is a predictor of the challenges ahead of us in terms of keeping schools and businesses open. Is sports once again leading?
Yes, sadly. My phrase in my class, which I teach at the University of Michigan on the history of college athletics, is sports do not exist in a vacuum. I said that before I knew about this, but that has been proven true in spades. And we see what? That if, you know, the society around you is not ready to handle this based on the numbers, the quarantine policies, the availability of ICU beds and so on, that you're probably going to start out and then pull back. And it's not hard to imagine the schools and other institutions trying to open up and having to retreat just as fast. So as I've said throughout this process, and I know you agree with this, I sure hope I'm wrong. But so far, that's the way it's playing out.
Driving around, I've seen high schoolers practicing, getting ready for fall. Do you see high school sports programs making any key decisions right now about whether or not they're going to go ahead and play?
The Michigan High School Athletic Association has made the decision to go ahead so far. Now, that might be reviewed in August, which strikes me as crazy, frankly. And like the NCAA, I'm seeing questionable leadership here. When the Grand Valley School System has just announced this week that they're going to be virtual for the first 9 weeks, how can you ask high school football players and tennis players and so on to take risks that the students themselves are not taking? And the Michigan High School Athletic Association made that decision by Zoom. They were not willing to meet in person to tell high school teams, go ahead and practice in person. This strikes me as hypocritical.
Hmm. You've coached your share of high school hockey, I know. I mean, do you think it would be possible to hold athletic team meetings and practices, but just eliminate travel and competition? Maybe just break it down to the health and socialization aspects of this for the kids who play.
I think that's a wonderful idea. I don't know if it still solves the COVID problem, but it solves some other problems. And that is that the whole sports complex, and keep in mind I make my living doing this, I've coached high school hockey, played it, and you know, I write books about this stuff, and yet the whole thing has been overheated. I've been saying this for almost a decade. I think we'd be doing well to scale back travel teams, to scale back much of what exists in high school sports, to scale back certainly the insanity, which I now see in the college ranks, where you play half your games off campus before you play at home. I think that the IM sports model, the club sports model, is not a bad one. And as Rahm Emanuel, the former mayor of Chicago, said, never waste a good crisis. We have a crisis here that's far bigger than sports. We have a chance here to change some things that should be changed anyway, and a chance we probably will not have going forward. So I hope that we take this opportunity to add some sanity to all that we do and reconsider why we're doing this. Exactly what you said. The health and socialization aspects are really the benefits here, not the competition.
Everything is so exhausting right now. Work, parenting, just being out, going to the grocery store. Is any of this striving for a season hope against hope, is any of this worth it?
Well, in some ways, it's both sides of that equation. One, it's all too much. And, you know, trying to run a practice with masks on and so on and so forth, that's exhausting, more exhausting than normal. The flip side is the need to have some kind of release and also to do something together. One thing great about college football, for example, is when you cross that threshold at Ohio State or Michigan or Michigan State, we don't care about your politics, your age, your gender, any of this stuff. If you know when to stick your fist in the air on hail, you're okay. You're in. And as Ken Burns often said, we have too much pluribus and not enough unum, too much many and not enough one. And that's one thing great that sports does for us that we're missing now as well. So it's all exhausting. We could use some unum, and we're not going to get it, I don't think, this summer or fall.
John U. Bacon is the author of many books, including End Zone, The Rise, Fall, and Return of Michigan Football, and he is Michigan Radio's sports commentator. John, thanks for stopping in today.
Thank you, April.
We're always glad to hear your takes, whether it's the post-COVID economy, protests, what's happening to kids or seniors during the pandemic, or anything else that's on your mind. Send us an email. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can leave comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page. Or hit us on Twitter. Our handle is statesideradio. After the break, we're going to revisit our conversation with two collectors about their love of African-American art.
Just buy what you like and just enjoy it. Your investment is having the experience of having it in your life, and it changes your life.
That's next on Stateside. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. For a long, long time, the work of African-American artists did not get much recognition in the world of fine art. That hasn't stopped art lovers from building impressive collections of work by painters, sculptors, and others. Today, we're going to revisit a conversation with a couple of collectors who will talk about their love for the works that they've bought over the years and how the business of buying and selling work by Black artists has changed. George Anamdi is founder and owner of the Anamdi Center for Contemporary Art in Detroit. For several decades, it's been a go-to destination to see art and meet Black artists. We're also speaking with Reverend Anthony Artis. He's a minister and art collector living in Flint. Works belonging to his family were on view earlier this year at the Flint Institute of Arts in an exhibition called Wonderfully Made. Reverend Artis, George, welcome to both of you.
Well, happy to be here.
Hey, it's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Could we start out? Anthony, I just wanted to ask you about the first work that you bought.
Yeah, the first piece my family ever bought that had some kind of investment value, that was a real piece of quality art, was a 1904 circa etching by Henry Oswald Tanner, entitled The Disciples See Christ Walking on the Water. And
for those who don't know, he was really the first African-American painter to really gain recognition, wasn't he?
Actually, internationally, there were a couple other African-American artists that ended up leaving America, going to Paris, France, and I had a chance to be judged more so on their talent. But Tanner, what really touches my heart is the fact that he focused a lot on religious themes. His father was Benjamin Tanner, who was a bishop in the AME church, and his father was trying to get his son to walk in his footsteps, hoping to be a preacher or pastor. And he said, "Dad, you know, you use your pulpit to preach." He said, "I'll use my brush."
There are a number of works in the collection that are centered around themes of faith. Obviously, this one fit right in with your interests in a lot of ways and works on a lot of different levels. You and your wife, Davida, now have a collection that also includes works by Jacob Lawrence, you know, one of the masters, and contemporary artists, cutting-edge people like Yehinde Wiley. At what point did this become more than a collection of works that you liked and that inspired you?
Well, my big motivation, arts didn't really intercept my life until I was in my mid-40s. And at the time, I was working at the Ruth Mott Foundation in Flint and exposed to Marianne Mott's Mott Warsh collection. You know, being able to choose our works from her collection to hang in our office, it was a perk. But at the time, I knew nothing about art. I wasn't really reared in it. My last name is Artist, so I think God has a sense of humor. But I didn't appreciate it. One day, I made a flippant comment to my curator colleague, and I said, "Whoever this Jacob Lawrence guy is," I said, "my son can, you know, draw better than him, and he's in the third and seventh grade." And she says, "Really?" So the piece we were looking at was entitled St. Mark. She said, "Anthony, here's what I want you to do. I want you to research the piece, research the artist and the subject matter. Let's just have a conversation." That piece, it had a picture of a black man, real dark color, a unique uniform. And after I began to research it, went home, Googled it, I realized that piece was General Toussaint Louverture, who led a place called Little Hispaniola or Little Spain or Haiti.
That we know now as the architect of the Haitian Revolution.
Exactly. And he led a group of people who were migrants or sharecroppers or farmers to fight for their liberation against the Spanish army and the French army simultaneously. And they won their freedom. You know, usually you always read about a group of blacks that rise and they all get slaughtered. You know, Nat Turner and stuff like that. You know, they all get massacred and captured. But in this case, they won their freedom. And this is against Napoleon Bonaparte and the Spanish army as well. And I was floored. And at that point, then I began to research Jacob Lawrence, and I realized he was one of the most prominent African-American artists at all time. And I was ashamed. I was ashamed that I didn't know about these people. And so when I went to work on Monday, you know, I ate a big chunk of humble pie. And the curator, she says, "Anthony, listen," she said, "by the way, these pieces in your office are more than your salary." And at that point, you know, being an undergrad in accounting, you know, the financial piece as well as the historical piece and the beauty of it, it just really, that's when I got bit hard by the art bug.
Yeah. George Anamdi?
Yes.
When you first opened your gallery in 1981, what was the art scene in Detroit like?
The art scene in Detroit in 81, it was very unique. It was active art scene, but we didn't have galleries per se. And I really started the gallery. I was trained, I have a degree in psychology from the University of Michigan here, and I thought of the arts being something for our community's mental health.
And we were coming out of the 70s, you know, just an explosive period of black creativity in Detroit.
Exactly. We had a lot, but we didn't have galleries. But we did our first exhibition in 1981. It was all abstract art, and all the artists there were from New York. And that was a great exhibition. I didn't know how great it was until other people started telling me, and then it got written up as the best group exhibition of the season. And to have that on your first exhibition was huge.
How did you talk to people about collecting when you first started out?
Well, I started buying art when I was 22 years old. I bought my first piece. I was at Ohio State. My tuition was $150. And I spent $125 for art. And everybody thought I was just crazy. And I thought I was crazy, too, because, like, who buys art at 22, right? So I understood the feeling that people would have, the reservations about spending, because I had it myself. And oftentimes, I would just take art to people's homes. I would place it on their walls. I'll come back a month, 6 weeks later, and see if they liked anything. And they said, "Oh, I can't afford it." So I said, okay. I started taking it down. Then they start seeing the void. See, art changes your life, and you don't know that it has. You know, so you don't know that you've been living in this void with nothing on your walls, right?
So they couldn't imagine the space without it.
Yes. Yeah. Let's work this out. Let's see how we can work this out. So that's how it became, you know.
Every art collection is really a kind of personal statement. Mm-hmm. How do you bring people along to understanding what their own collections might mean to them?
A lot of people come and say, I don't know what I like. And I give you one example. I had someone said that to me, and I said, okay, let me see your closet. So I went to their closet and saw the colors and the styles that they had. Then I came back a couple weeks later and presented work. He said, oh, I like this. He said, how would you know I like that? Well, everyone has a taste. You haven't had the opportunity to articulate it in art. I'm always trying to educate where you expand your vision. I don't want to change it. Just expand it.
Hopefully, works of art aren't just a look, but also an idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Anthony Artis, when I went to see the exhibition drawn from your collection at the Flint Institute of Arts.
Thanks for going.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's really wonderful.
Thank you.
I loved seeing the works by big name artists, but I was also so in love with work by artists that you helped me to discover. There's an etching there by a guy named Benny Andrews that just captures four kids on a dreamy summer afternoon kind of moment.
Yeah.
And there's a print by the Brooklyn artist who created the series Stop Telling Women to Smile, who I'd seen her work. I didn't even realize I knew who she was. But she did street art portraits of women sort of punching back against street harassment. Her name is Tatiana Fazlalizadeh.
Mm-hmm. Good job.
I practiced. What kind of moments of discovery do you get out of looking at art?
Oh, wow. For me, each of the pieces we have kind of has their own personal story. Like, it's one piece by Michael B. Platt, and it's a picture of two sisters, and one has their arm around the other sister, and they're both young girls, probably definitely under the age of 7 or 10. But when I first saw the piece, it reminded me of a picture of my mother and her twin sister when they were 4 years old. My mother's a twin, and my father, he's a twin.
And oh, wow.
So, yeah. So it's, my mother's name is Juanita Artis, and my aunt is Melita Mosley. And so in the picture, they both had a bow on their hairs, little white dresses, and they had an arm around each other. And so when I saw the title of the piece, Two Sisters, immediately, you know, it took me to that childhood photo of my mom and her twin. And so first time we ever shared our art publicly, that was a piece that they focused on in their marketing materials. And I realized, you know, we didn't want to do any kind of copyright infringement. And so they said, Anthony, you better get the permission from the artist. So I was able to contact Mr. Platt directly. And in talking, he said, well, are you going to use this? You know, how are you going to use this image? And I said, sir, I said, we're going to do a lecture to educate people on what you're doing and just share information. He said, man, well, where's this going to take place? And I said, well, Flint, Michigan, and Flint Public Library. He said, get out of here. He said, my wife is from Flint. She was born in Flint. He says, Carol, hey, baby, they're going to do something in Flint. We're going to help them. And so all of a sudden, he just, I mean, no reservation. He was all in. And then he says, listen, if you're ever on the East Coast, he says, I live not far from Howard University. Come on, check us out. Let me show you my studio. And I felt like I met a long lost friend. And so 2 years later, David and I had the privilege of going to the East Coast to do some to attend a collector's event at the Driscoll Center at the University of Maryland. And then going out there, we had the wonderful privilege of meeting Michael B. Platt and his wife, Carol A. Bean. She's a poet. But long story short, they had this big dinner for my wife, Davida, and I. They really loved on us and treated us with kindness. And we really were long lost friends. And sadly, he passed last year. And but every time now I see this piece, it, you know, started out reminding me of my mother. Now it reminds me of a wonderful man who had a wonderful gift.
If you're just joining us today, my guests are Reverend Anthony Artis. He's a collector who lives in the city of Flint, and George Anamdi, founder and owner of Anamdi Center for Contemporary Art in Detroit. The art world has been through so many seismic changes in the past decade. It used to be that galleries were all about building relationships with collectors. And there's no gallery that's going to turn you away when you walk in. But the people who run galleries now have to spend a significant portion of their year on the road, running around international art fairs. You know, Art Basel is the name that everybody knows, but also Art Basel Miami, the LA Art Fair, Frieze New York. And at the same time, it seems like the art world is turning to African-American artists, like all of a sudden, to, you know, to fix a lack of representation.
Yes.
George Anamdi, how have things changed for the way that you do business in this environment?
Well, it's changed. I think, one, people think about investment a lot more. When they always talk about investment in art, you know. Well, when I started, art was not an investment for me. I mean, I thought it may appreciate a little bit, but not like it has today. And I always explain to people, because most of the time what you're buying is not really a serious investment. Just because you buy something from an artist doesn't mean it's going to really appreciate. But I do try to tell them, it's like, what you do, just buy what you like and just enjoy it. Your investment is having the experience of having it in your life, and it changes your life. It changes how you look at things. I had a abstract painting that I would come home to sometime and just look at, you know, and this float away in it, you know. So you have all these different kind of experiences. So it does change how you do things and how you see the world. We got to get back to buying it because you really like it. If you want to do a collection, try to have a direction with your collection. So your collection represents some type of theme or some type of style.
Artists exploring ideas in different ways.
You know, so like I have my collection is predominantly abstract.
Anthony, just in the time that your family has been collecting, have you noticed changes in what's going on and what's on the market and maybe sometimes who you're bidding against?
Yeah, I'm noticing when I first really woke up to it, right around 2009, we bought the Tanner piece. And I was made aware of Swan Galleries in New York. You know, they were the first ones to really have a specific African-American artist, you know, sale. And so I started out initially getting some of the catalogs and just getting familiar with the names. And so over time, you know, I would see some familiar pieces that were resurrected every few years, where now it just seems like, you know, they're starting to sell more. The values are just, you know, kind of mind-blowing. You know, I don't know if it's just trendy or people just waking up to it, but I'm starting to see a lot more people entering the game. I know Puff Daddy or P. Diddy bought the one Kerry James Marshall piece.
He's a serious collector.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, some of the people who let me know he bought it wasn't so much for his love, but really to make a mark saying I got the top, you know, piece at this value. And so, you know, people are in it for different reasons, but, you know, I'm in it because it really speaks to me and certain artists' stories speak to me. Benny Andrews, the piece that we had at the exhibition was called Dreamer, and it shows a few kids laying on the beach and they have a little afro. And when he was a child, you know, he just dreamed about being off the farmland in Plainview, Georgia, getting out the hot sun working. And ultimately, once he did get an education, travel the world via the Air Force, he saw a lot of dreams come true. But what really touches me about this man's story is the fact that he protested for a lot of New York galleries and for people to give people of color an opportunity to share and to show their works.
George Anamdi, If someone is the kind of person who most of the art they see is maybe on Instagram, and they're just thinking about themselves entering this space as a collector, I heard what you said, that you'd advise people to go for the art that moves you. But is there any other advice you would have for people who are thinking about collecting African-American artists right now?
Well, first of all, I would say that not only that it moves you, but I think you also need to have an advisor. The dealer is not a middleman in art, okay? It's not like a wholesaler.
They're right.
Not there. That's the market is really the dealer. And I always say that you know, the educated person, you get much further with the dealer knowing what you're getting.
Why not buy direct from artists?
Well, one, if an artist sells a lot directly to the public, they're going to spend a lot of their time just selling. They will not be creating. Okay. And the artist, if you want to create value, you need someone else telling people, this is great. Everybody come to your studio and you saying, I'm great. I'm great. You know, you don't want
to
hear
that. You need
to
be great.
Yeah, right. So a lot of times that's what happens. You know, the artists get caught up in just selling their own work and they don't go further.
George Anamdi, thank you so much for all your work over the years and for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
George Anamdi is the founder and owner of the Anamdi Center for Contemporary Art in Detroit. And we've also been talking with Reverend Anthony Artis. Works belonging to his family were on view earlier this year at the Flint Institute of Arts in an exhibition called Wonderfully Made. Thank you so much for being with us here and sharing some of your experiences.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Up next, we're going to hear more about the termination of the director of the Museum of Contemporary Art, Detroit, after allegations of racial discrimination surfaced. We'll be speaking with MOCAD's board chair about what happened after the break. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you were with us a little bit earlier in the week, you heard us talking with a trio of curators who've worked in Metro Detroit. They love the institutions they worked for, but as people of color, they all had stories to share about demeaning or abusive behavior. The art world's an amazing source for fresh perspectives, but it can also be an overwhelmingly white space. Our summer conversations on systemic racism continue today with Elise Fulton. She is board chair for the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, or MOCAD. And MOCAD terminated its executive director, Alicia Borowy Reeder, this week. It was one of the institutions where current and former staff had complaints about management's treatment. Elise Fulton, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Will you tell us a little bit about why MOCAD's board decided this week to terminate Alicia Borowy Reeder's work at MOCAD?
Well, I would say that everything started, clearly things started a long time ago. There's all this, all these letters and all these, you know, history of people being unhappy. But to tell you the truth, I wasn't aware of it as chair, and I don't believe other board members were aware of it either. And I first learned of all this dissatisfaction and all these horrible allegations against our executive director in sort of the middle of the night, July 3rd. I woke up and saw the article in Art News, and read this letter that was to MOCAD, although it had not been sent to us yet. It was sent. It was in the press, and there was my first aha moment, an eye-opening moment. And I was shocked, and I believe my fellow board members were shocked too. And although there was such a groundswell of anger, and clearly anger and pain from the employees and former employees, I'm embarrassed to say that I wasn't aware of it. And none had spoken with me about these challenges or this their dissatisfaction. And evidently what we've heard since in speaking with employees and speaking with many people, that it sounded like the atmosphere that was within MOCAD felt as if it would not receive complaints very well, and that there were concerns that employees or former employees might be retaliated against either at MOCAD or in the art world in general.
Yeah. I'd like to play a little piece of tape from Tiziana Baldenbro, a former Ford curatorial fellow, talking about her time at MOCAD. Her position was one that MOCAD asked the Ford Foundation expressly to fund to bring traditionally marginalized voices to the forefront. Let's play her comment.
It really does
sort of become this conversation about like, oh, you were brought on because of the color of your skin or because of your background. You know, there were several instances where we felt very tokenized as individuals. There were meetings where, you know, she would introduce us as the Ford Fellows who were brought in to bring the diversity to the curatorial vision.
That, again, was Tiziana Baldenbro, curator and artist who had worked at Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. Elise Fulton, you're saying that not only did the executive director not mention any of this tension to you, but that you never heard from any staffers or volunteers before July 3rd?
No, I haven't. I heard of one complaint about 3 years ago, and we spoke about it. And I thought it was resolved because the person who had quit at that time because they were dissatisfied and took another job, 2 days later came back and wanted their job at MOCAD again. And so that surprised me. And it seemed as if the relationship was moving much more smoothly after that. I never heard of any complaints. So the one complaint I did hear about 2 years ago when an employee was leaving, and it was during an exit interview, this employee made the comment. I hadn't heard anything since then. So I was not aware of it. And as you mentioned, the Ford Foundation supported us through the Ford Fellows. And I personally never heard them introduced to bring a minority into the forefront. I've only heard, and in speaking with the Ford Foundation, we've only discussed, this is being the most talented of talented future curators. And I've never seen them as anything else. And Tiziana, by the way, has a brilliant show up right now, and it just proves how, you know, how creative and capable she is. So I'm saddened to say that I wasn't aware of it.
These problems are not exclusive to MOCAD. There are any number of reports and studies noting that nonprofits are, by and large, not very diverse. There are definitely people who work for arts nonprofits where most of their colleagues are white, most of their bosses, their board members are white. Do you think that this model that everyone's been working with for so long can deliver anything other than a system that puts a low priority on the experiences of people of color?
Well, I can only tell you that at our organization, speaking of diversity and trying to get increasing diversity on specifically our board has been a goal for a long time. And we've made some progress on that front, although clearly not quick enough, and not enough. And this is an opportunity for us to do that. I mean, I'm learning now through this process that rather than asking, you know, contacts in the community who might know of people that could be of support to us on our board, I've got to stretch farther to find more people that might have other relationships as well. And we've got to do this faster. And when we look at this as an opportunity to do that. I mean, to do things faster and better and more broadly. I mean, this decision really jumpstarts our initiative to serve as an agent for change in Detroit and in the art world. And I think it's an exciting opportunity we have, and we've got to live up to our challenge.
What changes are you planning in hiring and employment practices?
Well, we had this investigation, as I think you're aware, and from that investigation, besides having interviewed many people, this independent investigator is also working with us and identifying things that might have helped us avoid these problems. For instance, maybe our bylaws could have been improved upon. Maybe the communication chain could have been improved upon. Maybe, I think most definitely at our board meetings, we had to have more time separate from perhaps the executive director or any management of the museum to really discuss with employees and other stakeholders in the museum what challenges they might be facing. So taking them away from a meeting that they might be confronted by the executive director. So I think that we're identifying things like that can really help us hear and listen better to all of our stakeholders. And that includes artists, includes our, you know, employees at the museum, includes former employees, includes funders, and it includes the entire community. We're really, this was such a wake-up call that is just demonstrated to us we've got to really, really listen and create forums that we can get together with people and listen.
Both Tiziana and Maceo Keeling, who's another former Ford curatorial fellow, talked about maybe it being time for different kinds of structures within. You know, this this situation that's happened and that you're dealing with has obviously been big news within art circles. DIA is going through its own issues with diversity, equity, and inclusion. I'm sure you're aware the longtime director of MoCA Cleveland, a bit south of here, recently stepped down after one of the museum shows drew criticism from the mother of Tamir Rice, who felt that they were expressing her son's death in an inappropriate way. Do you feel like this is a moment of reckoning for contemporary art?
I think this is a moment of reckoning for everybody in every industry, including contemporary art. And and we should take advantage, and that's what MoCAD is trying to do, is take advantage of this moment of reckoning.
Have folks on the board have conversations among themselves about reckoning with systemic bias?
We have had those conversations, and we, you know, especially during this period right now where we've been trying to mark to market what's been taking place at our own museum and make decisions on how we'll move forward.
What kind of stuff comes up?
Well, we're looking at hiring practices and compensation and benefits that employees get. We're looking at the work environment much more carefully. And I think this moment of reckoning, again, means that everybody has to be a much better listener. That even if there is not intentional or outright, even if it's not intentional racism, things can be hurtful and painful to somebody that's hearing what's being said. And we've all got to become much more sensitized to that. I know that in our plans going forward, we hope to bring in somebody that can help us with that, have a heightened sensitivity to the way we speak and to the way we interact with each other. That's certainly on our list of things we plan to be doing in the future.
What's the plan for replacing the executive director, Alicia Borowy-Reeder?
You know, we are planning on hiring a national search firm and for hiring a new executive director. And although we have in the past focused on getting a group of candidates that are very diverse, I think that's going to be even more of a priority at this time. And in the interim, we're really blessed to have extremely dedicated and capable and long-term employees who can fill the void for right now. It's been very interesting that despite all the turmoil and longer-term dissent, our employees and even those who've been speaking up are remarkably committed to MoCAD. Through all this, current and former employees have repeatedly expressed their love for our museum. As opposed to wanting to throw the baby out with the bathwater, our employees and former employees and people in the community have said they want to be part of the rebuilding process. And I think that really speaks volumes about what MoCAD is seen as and how MoCAD is embraced in the community.
Elise Fulton is the board chair of the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. Right now, the museum has a really amazing exhibition up by the artist Peter Williams. Elise, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We received a statement from Alicia Borowy-Reeder after our conversation with Elise Fulton. It reads as follows. I was deeply disappointed to learn from a press release that I was terminated from my contract by the MoCAD Board of Directors after an investigation I disagree with and was not interviewed for. Over the past 8 years, I have always worked hard for MoCAD, and I am extremely proud of my accomplishments. I take the workplace allegations that have been made to heart, and I'm profoundly sorry for any harm I caused. I'm sincerely committed to the dignity of racial justice, to healing, and to accountability. If you'd like to read her full statement, go to michiganradio.org. In a normal year, this would have been a great summer to sit out on a rooftop bar or patio and share cocktails with friends. But this year, the drinks are best served over Zoom. To that end, Lester Graham and Tammy Coxon have their first physically distant cocktail for you in our latest installment of Cheers.
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 Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings. Been a long time since we've been able to sit down and share a cocktail.
Been a long time.
Now, I want to make sure that everybody understands we are socially distancing. She's quite a ways away from me, and we're doing the best to make sure that everybody's safe here. So with that out of the way, what is that bottle? Because I've not seen that before.
Well, this is what inspired me to say, Lester, when can we start recording Cheers again? This is from Ann Arbor Distilling Company, and it's a brand new kind of spirit for Michigan, and they are calling it Misco.
Misco. I've heard of Pisco. Any similarities?
Exactly. So this is a grape brandy spirit, so an unaged or an immature brandy, which is exactly what Pisco is, but they're making it here in Michigan, so it's definitely got a different kind of Michigan spin to it.
And I guess probably they couldn't use that name anyway, right? It's a regional thing?
That's right. Pisco is a protected name, and, you know, M-I-S-C-O, it just fits.
Fits for Michigan, certainly. Tell me what it tastes like by itself.
Okay, so this is really interesting. So this is a grape brandy, and in Chile and Peru, where Pisco is made, they use the same kinds of grapes that you would use for wine. What Ann Arbor Distilling Company is using is actually Concord grapes. So the same things we make grape jelly out of, grape juice out of. So it has a very different flavor to it from a traditional Pisco, but it's still super aromatic. So when you smell it, you're really going to get a lot of aroma, which you won't necessarily peg as grapes right away. When I took a sip of it on its own, it opens up. It has this almost kind of candy flavor, but I mean that in a good way, just something that reminds me of lovely childhood memories of eating candy.
So it's not like super sweet like grape jelly or something
No, it's not sweet at all. It's distilled. It's a distilled spirit, so it's dry. And then it's kind of got this really interesting middle palate with some funky notes and then a little bit of a hint of grape jam at the end. And I just think it's really, really intriguing, and I can't wait to taste it in the drink I made for you because this is my first time trying it mixed, but I think it's going to be fantastic in this drink.
What drink do you choose for something like Misco?
Well, I'm going straight to the source and making a Misco sour.
Like a Pisco sour.
Like a Pisco sour.
All right. So what's in that and how do you make it?
So a Misco sour is 2 ounces of Misco. You could use Pisco if you can't get your hands on this. An ounce of freshly squeezed lime juice, 1/2 ounce of simple syrup, and then an egg white. And anytime we use an egg white, you want to make sure that you shake that up on its own before you add any ice so you can kind of get that egg white foam going.
They call that a dry shake, right?
That's right, the dry shake. Then I'll add ice, shake it again really well, and strain it out into a glass.
And as a result, it's really frothy on the top. You've got like little hearts on the top of it. How'd that happen?
That's right. So this drink is typically garnished with drops of Angostura bitters on the top of the drink. And then you can pull a toothpick or a thin straw through it, and it will turn those little dots of Angostura bitters into beautiful hearts.
I saw that when you did it, and it was magic. So are we going to take a taste of this
now?
Yeah,
I can't wait to try.
I've had a Pisco Sour before, and it's the end of this, as you're taking it, that you've realized, oh, there's something different here.
Yes.
And I'm going to take another sip just to get a better idea, see if I can actually describe it. I still would have not guessed Concord grapes.
I didn't guess until I talked to the distiller, Alyssa. And I said, Alyssa, what grapes did you use? She said, oh, it's all Concord. I was like, what?
But at the very end, there's just like, well, you said grape jam.
Grape jam.
Yeah. It's barely noticeable, but it's there.
But it's there. And what I like about it in this drink is it actually gives this really nice, bright, fresh kind of flavor. I don't know how many of the listeners might have a Concord grapevine around. We have one here in my neighborhood that everybody can kind of pick off of. And I'm not a grape jelly person or a grape juice person, but there's something really nice in the fall about eating those fresh Concord grapes. And this gives me just that little hint of it, but actually in a really nice, refined way, I think.
I think often when you're sipping a cocktail and if it reminds you of something that's really pleasurable in your life, just a hint of it, that really makes a difference, makes a better drink. I like this a lot.
Well, thank you. And thanks to Ann Arbor Distilling Company for inspiring me to call you up.
Cheers.
Cheers.
That's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank and April Van Buren, with help from interns Leah Baldori, Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our director is Mercedes Mejia, and the executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.